I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to a little addendum at the end of our series of your own personal Beatles. Our weekly run is finished, but we're back with a couple of sort of treats over the next couple of weeks of stuff that we couldn't quite fit into the regular one. So welcome, Robin. Nice to see you again.
Hello, Jack. How are you doing?
I am very well.
Don't lie.
I'm fine.
Yeah. We're both broadly fine.
We're both broadly fine. And who was your little bonus guest? It was a bit of a first for your own personal Beatles because, unfortunately, due to work commitments in my quote unquote real job, I wasn't nothing is real. Yeah. I wasn't able to make this interview, so you did it on your own, which was lovely for me because I got to listen to it like a punter.
Mm.
So you chatted to the writer Wendy Erskine.
Yes, I had a really good chat with Wendy Erskine, who's a brilliant short story writer from Northern Ireland. The kind of connection came about because I'm a big fan of her work. She brought out a book a few years ago called Sweet Home, which we talk about a lot in this episode. But she recently interviewed Paul Muldoon at the Belfast International Arts Festival. And Paul Muldoon, of course, edited the Paul McCartney lyrics. And so there was that connection. So we talked a little bit about that. But kind of relevant to both of us, because we recently went to the Royal Festival Hall to see Paul Muldoon and Paul McCartney in conversation, chaired by Samira Ahmed. And it was a pretty emotional experience, wouldn't you say, Jack?
Yeah, it really was. I didn't really know what to expect. I knew that we were going to hear some yarns being spun. Mm. No music, sadly. But yeah, just to sort of be in the room and to hear a lot of those stories, some familiar, some not so familiar.
Yeah.
A new sort of candor from Paul that I think we've got over the last few months or so.
Yeah.
Or the last year, which is really nice, actually. And as you say, the overriding thing was... It was quite emotional and very special evening just to sort of share the space with the great man, as you mentioned in the interview.
Yeah, and I think it was, as you say, Paul does seem to be looking back so much now, and the lyrics, it's a very, it is almost like his autobiography, isn't it? And it's, you know, as you said, it's as close to an autobiography as we'll get. And that there is this kind of, it was very, very moving to just hear him talk about his life. And as we say, there are yarns we're familiar with, but every time he does the stories, there's always something slightly different. Like, so when he talked about Let It Be in the Dream, he talked about it in a very vivid way about his mother actually being there. And it was nice to see her again, It was very touching. And, he mentioned John as well. And he said a thing which he said a few times before, which is, I wish I'd told him I loved him. But to hear him say that on stage was just, it was quite powerful, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it was a really lovely atmosphere as well. It was such a sort of, it was a nice crowd and a real kind of outpouring of love.
Yeah. And just a standing ovation when he walked on stage, which was just amazing, But it was brilliant because I was waiting outside by the artist entrance. I saw, when I got to the Royal Festival Hall, I saw a crowd of people gathered around. And there was a... Because people
just had
think,
to look.
Yeah, because people thought he was going to walk, come in through that way. I think after about half an hour, I thought maybe he's already in there. But it was just amazing. People walking by and going, "Oh, who are you waiting for?" And you go, "Paul McCartney." They go, "Oh my God!" Like that, and like people were just so, and they were just like, "Oh God!" And everyone, their face lit up when you just said his name. Mm. So that was the kind of experience of him when he walked walked on stage was just everyone was like, oh my God, it's him. You know, he's a real person.
What are you doing here?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was brilliant.
It's amazing he's never been on that stage before.
No.
As well.
Yeah.
It's quite surprising.
Yeah. And so what do you think of the lyrics book as well then? Because we've managed to get a copy of it, which we're sharing.
Yeah. like a sort of acrimonious couple.
Yeah, you're having A to M. No, you're A to M.
Well, I was a little bit, when the news of it kind of broke and there wasn't much detail of what exactly it was, I thought it might be in the sort of vein of the Dylan ones, which, big tomes that, just literally lyric books and nothing else. So I was a little bit, there seems to be a lot of kind of legacy content coming out around the film. I thought maybe it was a bit of a cash in on that. But actually, as you say, it is, it's so personal and there is this kind of new candor to it. There's something that feels slightly finite about it, which... It's mixed feelings, really, because it's quite melancholy, and it very much, I think, as we mentioned in another upcoming podcast, it very much has the tone of someone trying to set the record straight, knowing that there aren't many opportunities left to kind of do that. So it felt, that it's tinged with a sadness in that way, but it's also just full of, it's just such an unbelievably extraordinary story, his life. And it's a brilliant way of doing it, because I think it does work better than an autobiography, because as he says in the introduction, what can he add that hasn't been written about his life? And I don't think he is interested in a sort of like tell-all thing of like, finally let's address this thorny issue of how do you sleep or whatever it is. And it's really beautifully put together. There's so much sort of lost trinkets that are all obviously in perfect condition. And there's the amount of stuff that they kept is amazing. Yeah. Linda's photography is brilliant. There's a particular shot of Paul on the Bakerloo line in 1968 or something. And they're just, it's him looking absolutely gorgeous as per.
Well, I was just going to say, there's a photo of George Martin in Abbey Road in about 68 where he looks like the most handsome man who's ever lived. He's extraordinarily handsome, George Martin.
And just sort of that sort of iconography of the time is brilliant. And I actually really enjoyed this stuff a little later on. There's a bit in particular where he talks about Here Today, which is, again, a story we've heard him tell before, but not in such detail. And it's brilliant. It's I'm really glad that we bought it, because the price put me off a bit. But I'd say it is, if you're a Beatles nerd and a book person, it's a crucial buy.
Yeah. There's a great quote that I really liked, which is Paul says at one point, "John always managed to be a little bit older than me. I never caught up."
Yeah.
Which I just really loved that. And it's this idea that he was always that kind of slightly, older brother kind of relationship, which says so much about their relationship. I thought it was really beautiful. But I'm really fascinated by, and we talk about this a lot with Wendy, I'm really fascinated by the choice of having Paul Muldoon as the editor, because, Paul Muldoon he's a brilliant poet, but it's quite highbrow, and it's quite kind of, well, maybe highbrow is the wrong word, but it's very difficult and quite inaccessible poetry at times. Whereas Paul is the great communicator, I think.
You could never accuse Paul of being impenetrable.
No. So there were some lovely moments, I think, when we saw them at Royal Festival Hall, where Paul Muldoon was kind of trying to stress. There's kind of a bit of Irish stuff going on in the background here, and Paul McCartney's going, maybe, not sure. I think there's kind of, but I think that's what makes the book kind of nice, is this kind of, there's this push and pull between maybe Muldoon saying, oh, maybe there's this allusion to this, and maybe not, but it just creates this, I think, one of the ones I think I mentioned in the podcast is the influence of the go-between on She Loves You. It's like, I think that is a little bit of a leap, and they mentioned it in the thing, Let It Be is a line from Hamlet as well, but there's just this idea that there's all these ideas and books and quotations floating around, so some stuff is intentional and some not, but looking back now, you can kind of piece these fragments together. And I think that is why Muldoon is kind of really good, I think, because it is it's all about these illusions and things.
Well, I think it's a really, it's also a really nice counterpoint to the definitiveness of what I was saying about Paul, you know, getting this stuff down on paper, because I think he does understand that even if, you know, he will never be able to control the narrative.
Yeah.
And because of the nature of the music and stuff, and it is relatively opaque, a lot of it, and it's constantly going to be open to interpretation, so it's nice to have that other angle of like, well, maybe there is this, or maybe it's not conscious, or maybe, you know.
And I definitely do prefer this to say, like, you know, Christopher Ricks wrote a book about Dylan and
Visions of Sin,
and I definitely prefer the kind of Muldoon McCartney approach, where it's like they're not saying this is poetry in inverted commas. You know, and, you know, it's when you look at the lyrics on the page, you're only seeing part of the story. But, you know, so I like the way that they're still treating it as lyrics, but still valuing it as art. But it's not kind of taking it kind of, you know, too far, kind of going into, I don't know, post-structural Dianetics, which I just made up. But, you know.
Yeah. That's something to do with Scientology.
I think it is, yeah.
But I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a sort of suggestion with books like the Christopher Ricks thing, like calling something poetry somehow elevates it.
Yeah.
You know, into a sort of, you know, whatever it is, a more pure art form. Mm. But, you know, their songs are songs and they always will be.
Yeah. That's the other one I made a note of, is saying the influence of Long Day's Journey into Night on A Hard Day's Night is like... Mm.
It's pretty tenuous. Yeah. I mean, you can never rule it out.
You can never rule it out, yeah.
Yeah.
But
did Ringo just say it?
Yeah. But another couple of lovely thing in the at the Royal Festival Hall was that detail about Paul saying he was an angel investor on Joe Orton's lute, which I don't think had been revealed before, which was fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was amazing. Yeah. Mm. And
he said he didn't know what it was. Didn't know what an angel in the...
Well, he said, I was an angel. Like, and Samira Ahmed was like, what do you mean? He played an angel in a play? And he's like, no, wasn't it? Yeah, it's really funny. Mm. The other lovely discussion was about buses, which are obviously integral to Paul McCartney.
Mm.
Paul McCartney's kind of lyrical vision. He talked a lot about buses. And it was funny because after the event ended, we tried to find a drink in Soho with not much success because everywhere was absolutely packed.
We walked quite a long way.
Yeah. but I ended up getting the old favourite 176 back home. And I thought it was just really nice to end that night with this really lovely, you know, sometimes the night bus can be not very nice, but sometimes it can.
I was on the N3 and it wasn't that nice.
Right. But sometimes you can kind of just, you do just kind of get into that little cocoon and you kind of see the city go by. And I was listening to the song Night Bus by Burial, which is great.
Oh, nice.
And, but it was just, I felt like that, you know, this is kind of what Paul's going on about in a way, isn't it? You know, to be able to just see the world go by. And I thought it was a nice way to end that evening.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Yeah. We should also say hi to some of the listeners of the podcast that came and chatted to us, Nathan and Jacobs. And Nathan sadly tested positive for COVID, so couldn't make it to Paul McCartney, which is gutting, I imagine. But we chatted to Jacob outside the venue, and hope you enjoy your personal Beatles mugs.
Yeah.
And it was very nice to meet you.
Yeah, it was lovely to meet you. And we even signed the White Album for you, which felt very sacrilegious, really.
Yeah. So much negative space to scroll on. We got an email as well that I thought we got at the end of the last series, but it was a really nice one, so I thought I would dig it out. So this one is from Eric Capocella from Atlanta, Georgia, who says, I'm a huge fan of the podcast as well as a lifelong Beatles obsessive. This is a lovely long email, Eric, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I assure you we did both read it and really enjoyed it. But
thank you so much.
Some key bits that I thought were really nice. I know I've been listening to Beatles songs since the day I was born, but one of my earliest memories is hearing Within You, Without You on a family road trip. I remember being enamored with the sound of that song, not necessarily the music or the lyrics in particular, but the sound itself. Does that make George Martin my first favorite Beatle? Mm. My wife and I named our daughter Abby. She's 7 and currently learning Let It Be on her keyboard. You Never Give Me Your Money is next.
Amazing.
And last but not least, one day in 2003, I was walking out of the Saatchi building in 375 Hudson Street in New York City around 6 p.m. Who walked across my field of vision at that exact moment? None other than, do you want to have a guess, Robin?
Well, I've read the email, but...
Right, okay, well, it's Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
it's NYC, so people were actually very respectful of his privacy, or privacy, as they say. Most were sort of looking, gawking. I almost walked in the opposite direction, but knew I'd regret it for the rest of my life. So I scurried after him and told him I just wanted to shake his hand. We shook hands, he asked how I was doing, and I said something along the lines of, "Doing well. It's good to see you." My only regret was not asking him if he had time to grab a pint at Mr. Dene's right round the corner. Sadly closed down since.
Mm.
Almost 20 years later, I'm still in the process of writing a song called Hudson and Houston, the cross streets where I met him.
Amazing.
The saying goes, never meet your heroes, but I'd like to write a song about meeting him before it's too late, even if it's just a quick hello goodbye. Mm. Thanks for reading and keep up the great work. Thanks very much, Eric. What a lovely email.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric. That's brilliant.
We did have some time last week to think what would happen if we did bump into Paul walking through the green bar or out of the Skylon toilets.
I think that's the right thing. It's just, well, maybe not during COVID era, but, you know, a handshake. And, you know,
so thanks very much for listening. We don't have a Patreon anymore because we're not doing regular regular exercise, regular episodes.
I'm not
regular exercise at the gym. We thought we would, you know, it's probably not giving you great bang for your buck if we're not here every week. So we've sort of closed that down. And if you didn't get a chance, I know a few people have written and saying that they still want to hear the bonus ones, but they can't get them now because the Patreon has been closed, but there will be an opportunity. I think they'll see the light of day, sort of not behind the paywall in the future.
Yeah.
So hold tight, keep an eye on your feeds, and maybe when we've got a little bit of a lull, we'll stick some of those out. Mm. So, and a huge, huge thank you for everyone who did join the Patreon because it, made us be able to make the podcast we wanted to make this series and not have worry about losing too much money. which was really lovely. And it allowed us to do, you know, things like the Abbey Road stuff we couldn't have done without it. So thank you so much. For now, we'll be back with a little post amble at the end, but enjoy the Robin's brilliant interview with Wendy Erskine.
A quick note before this episode starts, I wanted to say in the introduction that I thought it was really interesting that Paul McCartney's lyrics book begins, the kind of epigraph is from Hamlet, and it is "to thine own self be true," but as anyone who's seen Clueless knows, that Hamlet doesn't say that. It's that old guy Polonius who is not the most honest character in the play. I thought it's kind of quite interesting about that Paul should choose to have that at the intro, because it says quite a lot about his kind of inscrutability, I think. But anyway, yeah, Wendy Erskine coming up. It's not the most Beatlesy chat, lots of chat about books and Paul Muldoon in particular, but it's a really interesting episode. And just a word about the sound quality. We were using Wendy's laptop mic, so it sounds a little bit roomier than normal, but your ears will soon adjust. Enjoy the show. Are you ready to just go, or do you want to get a drink or anything?
I have got a tequila. Yeah.
Oh, tequila, nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've got a Stella, not quite
Stella.
As
well, that's
classy, but you know. Is that like sipping tequila then, or is it?
I'm no good at necking things, so I'm never really good into that. So I kind of like sipping a tequila. Sometimes I'll have it with orange, and sometimes I'll just sip it. I like mezcal, nice. So they're lovely to sip as well.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah,
that's me.
Great. Awesome. Right. I'm going to be professional and pretend I'm on Radio 4 or something. But so Wendy Erskine is a Northern Irish writer. Her first collection of short stories, Sweet Home, was published in 2018 and was longlisted for the Gordon Byrne Prize. Her next collection, Dance Move, is published next year. And I came across Wendy when someone on Twitter was recommending collections of short stories, and Sweet Home came highly recommended. So I bought it and was absolutely blown away. But anyway, welcome to your own personal Beatles, Wendy Erskine.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thanks for inviting me. to join you.
The new book, Dance Move, is out next year. So what can we kind of expect from that? Is it kind of different from Sweet Home, or is it kind of... It's another collection of short stories, right?
It's another collection of short stories. So it's another 11 short stories. And essentially, I don't think it's not a radical departure from Sweet Home at all. So if you like Sweet Home, you might like this. And if you didn't like Sweet Home, you probably won't like this. So it's the same sorts of people with the same sorts issues and difficulties and, you know, lives that are complicated and so on.
Yeah. Well, that's what I love about your stories. We'll get to the Beatles in a bit, but that's what I love about your stories is they're so well observed and they're full of nuance about the way people talk and the way people communicate. And they're all kind of have this quality where that nothing's ever quite resolved, or, you know, or where my favorite one, I think, is the story itself, Sweet Home.
Oh, you like that one, do you?
Yeah.
Why do you like it?
Well, I just love that idea of it starts with this kind of image of building this community center, and it talks about the weeds and they cut back the weeds, and it ends with the weeds kind of growing back. And there's this sense of just nature carries on while people just carry on, you know, falling apart and getting back together again. And, you know, it's just this nice way of kind of zooming out at the end. And there's this kind of, I like your stories because they're sort of slices of life, and you see a little snapshot and then the camera pans away again, kind of.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's really nice. Yeah. That kind of was what I was hoping might happen with that one, that it would be, we've got all our messy human complications, but, you know, the knotweed keeps on growing. And
exactly.
That's life.
Yeah. So I started reading Sweet Home when I was sort of trying to not read about the Beatles for once. And in one of the stories.
Is that what you do a lot? You would read everything?
Yeah. Well, I mean, since we started the podcast, it's been a process of realizing how little I know about the Beatles. So it's kind of constantly trying to revise, kind of as if it was for an exam kind of thing. So it was a nice break from the Beatles, but then I sort of realized the Beatles are completely inescapable, because you mentioned Rocky Raccoon in one story. But you also mentioned music a lot in your stories, and there's a brilliant story of yours we'll come on to about Gil, a fictional musician called Gil Courtney. But I just wondered what's the place of music in your life? Like, how does it inform your work, and how important is music to you?
Music's really, really important to me. And it's probably what I'll notice loads more than, say, for example, you know, a tree or a cloud formation or whatever. And so, you know, whereas some writers, that might then become an important part of the story, you know, some aspect of the natural world, whatever way some leaves were dropping or whatever, I'm probably going to notice the music blasting out of a car as it drove past the tree or whatever. So that's just naturally what I'm going to be interested in. And I suppose I'm kind of interested in music as just part of the fabric of people's lives, Robin. So it's not really trying to write about, you know, characters listening to cool music or anything like that. It's kind of just that the music is part and parcel of human experience, I suppose. I would say the story that you're talking about, that one, which is about a person who has a possibly a religious experience, or possibly it's a drug-induced experience in a hotel. You know, they open the drawer in the hotel and there's a Gideon's Bible. And I mean, I've never opened a drawer in a hotel and seen a Gideon's Bible without thinking of Rocky Raccoon. It's a Pavlovian response. I mean, I have never not thought of that song. But then I suppose you're kind of stuck whenever you think about this guy in this story called Andy. I imagined him, he's about 24, about 25, and you kind of think, right, okay, I'm presenting this as his response when he opened the drawer, that he thought about Rocky Raccoon and was trying to get the narrative in his head, you know, who shot who and what was the mythology and so on. So you think, right, is that viable for a 24-year-old to be thinking of Rocky Raccoon, or am I imposing my own view of things and my own worldview and my own response onto a 24 year 24-year-old guy. But I think that's the thing with the Beatles. It's entirely feasible that this 24-year-old guy could also think that. You know, there's some other groups that I could have picked. And I don't mean the Gideon's Bible, but I mean in terms of a response to something else, it wouldn't have worked because it would be so obviously me imposing my own likes or whatever. But I think with the Beatles, that's absolutely the case that a guy of 24 could look and could think that.
Absolutely, yeah, I think so. But I mean, you are right. I mean, there are people, you know, I remember, you know, I met someone who I used to work with who hadn't heard of Neil Young. I'm not saying that as a critical way, but you'd be surprised by how not well-known things that we think of as being well-known are, you know.
Well, I think that's the thing, and it's very kind of, you know, it can be really presumptuous to assume that people are going to, you know, have the same reference points as you. Like, I can remember talking to somebody and they were talking about the birds, and for me, the Birds is absolutely the Birds, the band, but they were meaning this Aristophanes thing. I would never, million years, have ever come up with that. You know,
maybe that's why they spelled it with a Y, just to distinguish that.
Yeah, just to guess all these people that could be confused. Yeah,
I love that. So in that story, I mean, the story is called The Last Supper, but I mean the religious element to it for me, I mean, obviously it's set in the church, in a little cafe in a church, but it I mean, it doesn't, that element that this was this kind of revelatory experience for him, it's quite submerged for me, maybe. I don't know. I like that. I mean, could you talk more about that story? It's because it's really quite a powerful story, and it's also very funny.
So this story is set in a cafe that is for it's a cafe that I've imagined. This cafe is run by a church in collaboration with a charity, a sort of a mental health charity. And I don't know if you have cafes like that in London, Robin, but there would be quite a few cafes around here that would be of that ilk, that they're kind of that they've got a sort of social function, that they're not just simply businesses. And I can remember one day I get migraines a lot. I remember one day I had a really bad migraine. I ended up going for a walk, and at the end I ended up in one of these cafes. And to me, the place just seemed so, I always get, it's after a migraine has passed for me, everything is just so unbelievably vivid and saturated. Life is just high. And I remember just thinking about this cafe, that this, I'm going to set a story in a place like this, because everything seemed heightened. You know, everything seemed, you know, just really kind of, everything seemed so meaningful. So basically, I was thinking of, I was thinking of a cafe like that. I was thinking also of the whole idea of small kind of apocalypses, the idea that what causes people to kind of maybe be tipped over the edge, or what causes, you know, any kind of breakdown, it might not necessarily be precipitated by something huge. So I wanted to think about people's world, in a sense, coming to an end, and what was going to happen would be this cafe was going to be jeopardized, and this cafe was going to come to an end, and that had major, major, major repercussions for the people who worked in it. So basically, this cafe is run by this young man, Andy. He's trying his best. All the people who work in it have all got various difficulties in life. Two of the very young people who work in it end up having sex in the toilets. And this then causes a whole chain of events that really means that this cafe that has really been a kind of a shelter, a sanctuary for the people that work in it, is totally jeopardised. So I was kind of thinking, there's a couple of things. I was trying to weave in stuff to do with Yeats, the Second Coming. So it was all, there's lots of stuff there to do with, you know, collapse and things not being able to hold and so on. But I was also thinking there's a Dutch artist I really, really like called Maurice van Tellingen. He's got it's a beautiful little sort of 3D piece of a little kind of birdhouse in the middle of a very bleak garden. And I was imagining the cafe as that. There's this kind of little shelter. But anyway, at the end, it's also Last Supper. And it's kind of like these people, instead of having, they're having a kind of a communion, but it's kind of cheap old non-alcoholic cava.
And Battenberg.
Really spilled Battenberg cake. Yeah. And this around the table because it's all going to end.
Yeah. Yeah. It's done with such a light touch though, as well, because I love that kind of, we know everyone in the cafe's got their histories and their problems, but it's done so lightly. Like there's a brilliant bit where the girl's asked to roll her sleeves up and then they just go, oh no, don't actually. And you kind of guess that maybe there's some self-harm or something like that going on. Yeah. But it's done so lightly and it's not, you know.
Yeah.
It's a really brilliant story.
Thank you. Kind of hoping, I suppose, with these stories, I suppose different stories work different ways, but you're kind of hoping that you've got a reader that kind of meets you halfway, you know, and it's going to supply quite a lot of ideas themselves. And
yeah.
I was talking to my friend the other day and he was saying about there's a metaphor that it's actually George Eliot in Middlemarch uses of a spider's web, but she's talking about courtship. But I think it works really well for stories, for short stories, the idea that it's like a spider's web, but the structure's so dependent on the gaps and the structure's so dependent on the space as much as it is in any of the actual web.
Yeah.
You crush it all together, it's absolutely nothing. And yet when you look at it, it can hold quite a lot. But it's all to do with the gaps in the spaces where other people are inserting their own meanings and their own implications and so on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's brilliant. I mean, there's a great in the Paul McCartney interview he did with Adam Buxton. I think he said he was reading Proust at the time, which is quite impressive. But he said something about, I like it when a book likes you. You know, which is that idea of the book meeting you halfway for the reader as well.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You recently interviewed Paul Muldoon at the Belfast International Arts Festival, and Paul Muldoon obviously has edited the Paul McCartney lyrics, and we saw both Pauls at the Royal Festival Hall. Jack and I did last week, which was brilliant.
Was it amazing? Really good?
It was really good. It was like quite emotional just being in the same room as him, you know. It was just more... just to be able to see him and to share that space with him. And it was hosted by Samira Ahmed as well. And she asked some really, really interesting questions, because I think when you follow Paul, there are lots of Paul McCartney, there are lots of questions he gets asked a lot, and he kind of often does the kind of same stories. But there's some really interesting questions. Like, you know, she asked him about dreams. Did he dream of Liverpool and things like that? And I thought that was kind of really nice.
What did he say? I mean, did he say?
Yeah, he did. And he said he sort of had classic kind of, you know, Kafkaesque dreams where he always wanted to go to some place and he couldn't quite get there and stuff, but it was all familiar terrain of Liverpool. It was all recognisably Liverpool and stuff, and then kind of led on to kind of the famous songs that were inspired by dreams, like Yesterday and Let It Be, obviously. But I'm interested in the Muldoon connection, because we're talking about like writers there who, you know, where you're kind of meeting the reader halfway. Muldoon has got a reputation as being quite a difficult poet. I mean, it's kind of very dense poetry, so many allusions and kind of playing on words and multiple meanings of words and things, and very intricate rhyming. But so what do you think, and I don't know if this came up in your conversation with Paul Muldoon, but what do you think the link is there with Muldoon and McCartney?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we ended up talking about, I was there to talk to him about how he scalped the new collection with Faber, which is, you know, a lot of poetry, as you say, that is, it really kind of all sorts of really interesting and unusual forms and repetitions and puns, and you know, in some way you would say not super accessible. But what we ended up talking about a bit was we ended up talking a bit about song lyrics. And we also ended up talking a bit about we talked a lot about poetry. But he said I'm sure they probably talked a little bit as well that evening about how he kind of got connected with Paul McCartney in terms of this mutual friend that they had, who had wanted him to work, that had thought they should work together and so on. But I suppose one of the things that really interested me was that I've read Paul. Paul Muldoon was kind of saying quite a lot to do with the form and structure. That form and structure, it's because I was quite interested in that, the kind of diversity of forms that he was using. And he was saying that form in and of itself is totally irrelevant. It's only whenever the form is helping to put forward a certain sort of an idea. And I didn't get to ask him something that I really, really wanted to ask him, which was, you know, he said that he thought that the problem with the way poetry was sometimes taught in school was that people were taught that what it means is not actually what it means, that there is, in a sense, this other sort of subtext that you have to kind of unlock. And I find that really interesting, because I do actually teach kids. I do teach poetry to kids quite a lot, and I know, yeah, Robin, that's their response quite a lot of the time. You know, they'll sort of nudge each other and say, do you get this one? Do you get it? In the sense that there's something to get, and that whatever it is in the surface is not actually what it's really, really about. And so Paul Muldoon was saying, in fact, that's the wrong way around. What things are about, what the poem is about, is actually what the poem is about. And that's your starting point, as opposed to looking for some sort of subtext. But it kind of led me on to think about song lyrics and how people are kind of, I think a lot of people maybe find that poetry makes them feel sort of slightly foolish, because they sometimes don't get what it is they think they should be getting. Whereas I don't think many people think that about song lyrics whatsoever. So in a sense, people have got much more tolerance of ambiguity when it comes to songs. They actually really quite enjoy that. Yeah. Whereas with poetry, it's seen as something kind of baffling.
Or kind of elitist, maybe, or like you need to have read these books to read this book, kind of thing. It can be quite off-putting, I suppose, for some people. But I think one thing that I do like about Muldoon, and I've been reading Howdy Scalp as well, is like how, even if it is very dense with allusions, he's not like in an ivory tower kind of, you know, there's stuff about, he mentions playing Red Dead Redemption. So it's like he does have that way of crossing this kind of, for want of a better word, like high and low brow kind of thing. So, and they are enjoyable. There is the stuff that made me laugh in there. There's a bit where he's on a plane and someone asks him if he has any food allegories, you know, which I thought was really funny. And I think that's really interesting, because I think, you know, there's a poem, a very long poem in there called American Standard, which is obviously like full of echoes of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And it's a poem which I read, and it's one of those things where you read and it's like you're not sure you're getting everything, but it is generating this picture in your mind where it is about the Wild West and it is about Trump and it is about the kind of loss of meaning in America and at this time, maybe. So it's like, even though that's not explicitly there, and even though you're not getting everything, it is creating this image in your mind, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way that probably couldn't be expressed any other way,
and,
you know.
Yeah, and as you say, it's pretty democratic in terms of the references, you know. I'm not maybe going to get some of me. I was a person who didn't get Aristophanes whenever a person was talking about the birds, you know.
Yeah.
There's going to be stuff that I don't get, but I'll probably pick up on the Bowie. I'll probably pick up on the Trent Reznor. I'll probably pick up on, you know, the PlayStation games, the Xbox games or whatever. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the interesting thing, I think, with referencing The Wasteland, it's like, I think The Wasteland is such an interesting poem because it's like, when you read it now, I think it's hard to get a grasp of how revolutionary it was at the time. Because nowadays, when you look at it, you go, oh yeah, it's like song lyrics. And like, mm-hmm. we don't expect song lyrics to make sense in the same way, in the kind of literal linear way. You know, but I think you can see the influence of Eliot in the way, as you said, we kind of don't expect song lyrics to have the kind of straightforward meanings, or to kind of, they might take you from one place to another really quickly, and it doesn't really matter kind of what, you know, you can have yeahs as a chorus, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Nobody has an issue with any of those things at all. And in fact, the person that probably reads loads into song lyrics is the one that's regarded as the unusual individual in this household anyway, you know.
Yeah.
I'm always pointing out things like, oh well, why is he saying that whenever he's just said he's moved into another room and then he's now talking to her in the same, you know, that's just seen as being tediously pedantic and so on. No, I wondered. Yeah. There's one of the sort of sequences in Heidi Skelt that I thought was absolutely wonderful was the one about the sequence about the band poems, which were all on a sequence of poems that are all on art pieces. Did you read that?
I'm ashamed to say I haven't got that far yet.
I have since read this section and it's very, very good and very, very rude.
Well, it's like it's 23 band poems, but each poem is about a painting, and I kind of, this is another thing I didn't ask him about, but I kind of thought, I wonder if I'll get even more out of this if I go and look at the paintings that the poems are written about, and I kind of did. It kind of helped me, and I kind of thought about that looking at song lyrics without the actual melody, you know.
Yeah.
To what extent, you know, that kind of writing where you're writing about something visual, to what extent does it actually help you to have the visual thing here? Are those two things kind of quite symbiotic in terms of, you know, the meaning that's created?
Mm. Yeah.
But they're great. They're super. They're brilliant. Very funny as well.
Great. I mean, there's a brilliant sequence. It's in Hay, Paul Muldoon's earlier collection, which is all about there's a sequence of poems about albums. Do you know that one?
I don't know.
Because there's one about the White Album in there, which is really, really interesting, although it's hard to work out how it's about the White Album. But it's obviously about his kind of associations, I think, of hearing it for the first time. I mean, should I read it? Or is that going to be kind of what I said?
Yeah, no, good. I'd love that.
It's very short. Okay, so this is The Beatles by Paul Muldoon. Though that was the winter when late each night I'd put away Cicero or Caesar and pour new milk into an old saucer for the hedgehog, which, when it showed up right on cue, would set its nose down like that flight back from the US, back from the yes sir, back from the USSR. I'd never noticed the play on album and white. Okay, and I had to tweet that out because I've never understood what he meant by that. But the riddle is, album is Latin for without colour. It's actually Latin for white colour or whiteness, and it comes from the adjective albus, meaning white, which is also part of the word albumen for egg white. I am the egg man, wheels within wheels, eggs within eggs.
Right.
So white album is a kind of punning thing.
Right. Well, you learn something new every day.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that's
great.
Very good. That's good.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's great.
But I mean, you know, there's not kind of he's not saying that that was a deliberate pun. And I think Muldoon with McCartney is often saying it doesn't matter if this is intentional stuff, mm-hmm. whether there's allusions, it's kind of seeped in other ways. What do you think of kind of McCartney's lyrics in general? Have you had a chance to look through the lyrics book at all?
I haven't had the chance to look through the the lyrics book, no. But you know, I suppose I like all sorts of different songs for all sorts of different reasons. But I do like songs where I think I'm given a world only to, obviously this is the answer, short story writer, you know, I like songs where I think I'm given a world, not the only sort of song I like, but the sort of song where you're given a world in two and a half, 3 minutes, that sort of vignette style lyric, I absolutely love, you know.
Is there any specific Beatles ones that summon that world or create a world for you?
Not even just Paul McCartney ones, but say, for example, No Reply. I think it's wonderful for capturing something like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know? It's so powerful, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's like almost punky, you know.
It is. And you've got like that sort of chiming. You've got that quality. It's like that. It's I Saw the Light. It's a lie. You know, you've got that almost. It's like a slant. It's like an almost. It's a repeat there, like a chiming repeat of a particular sound. And I think that just works so brilliantly.
Yeah. You know? And it's quite weird that kind of, I suppose, it's a classic Lennon thing of being sounding quite ecstatically, saying something quite depressing or something, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
But do you think, I mean, McCartney in the lyrics book, it comes across like very, I mean, his poems communicate to people, don't they? They're very direct. You know, so that's what I think is interesting about the Muldoon relationship is because, you know, Muldoon's a brilliant poet, but maybe...
I don't know why it took me so long to express quite a basic idea here, which is that McCartney's lyrics are quite easy to understand and Muldoon's poems are quite difficult to understand, although they are enjoyable. Anyway, on we go.
But, like, McCartney isn't quite as dense with the allusions, let's say, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Paul Muldoon must be open to an incredible range of different sorts of writing and different sorts of work. And like, I know that he's been really supportive of what I do, and has been really really kind about it, and would say that he really likes it. Now, by no means am I saying that I am in any way like Paul McCartney, right?
Yeah, you can say it if you want.
But, I mean, I am not making that connection at all, but it's what I do is very, very different to what Paul Muldoon does, and yet he can kind of see something that he likes in mine, which really doesn't make... it's not as formally experimental even as many even short story writers are. But you can see something there, I suppose. So, you know, he talked very much about, you know, people at that event in Belfast were asking about, oh, you know, Dylan winning the Nobel and, you know, are songwriters ever really poets and all the rest of it. And I think, you know, he was pretty much saying, well, you know, Paul McCartney is artist, is a poet.
Mm. You know? Yeah. What I like about the book is that it kind of, it doesn't treat them as like sacred texts. Like they say in the introduction, you know, we're very light with the punctuation, which I do think works with song lyrics. You don't want it to be punctuated exactly like a poem because it's not a poem, you know, but certainly some of the, like She's Leaving Home, obviously, Eleanor Rigby, you know, Another Day. They are beautiful vignettes, you know, they are, you know, they're people and you can see them, you know, they're very vivid, you know. Like there was a great bit when we saw them at the Royal Festival Hall and Paul McCartney was saying, you know, sometimes Paul Muldoon would say, what about when I saw her standing there, you say, you know, the way she looked was beyond compare. Is that a reference to this Irish ballad? And Paul McCartney would be like, no, I'm sadly not. But yeah, sometimes there is that kind of, I think it's in the bit about She Loves You, Paul McCartney saying, like, you know, maybe this was a reference to The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley, and it's like, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch.
You know? Do you find that kind of background interesting, Robin, just purely because it's an interesting fact or it's an interesting perception or whatever? Or does it affect how you, that whole sort of contextual aspect, does it affect how you respond to the music?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it does, I think. Yeah.
Does it? Yeah.
I think having some of that historical, and obviously it doesn't, you know, as we were saying with the kind of White Album pun thing, it doesn't really matter if stuff wasn't intended. It's nice to kind of have that kind of ability to think of the kind of stew of things that was going on in the 60s. So little things would have made their impact in the song lyrics in different ways, I think.
Yeah. Because say something like, she said, right, whenever I moved to Glasgow, I started going out with a guy, and I can remember him saying, you know, I said to him, what's your favorite Beatles song? And he said, she said, and I remember then listening to it loads because that's what he said his favorite Beatles song was. And I can remember at the time, you know, he was somebody that, I don't mean I was a country bumpkin exactly, but I wouldn't have grown up in a house where people really listened to lots of interesting, in inverted commas, music, or really would have read tons. Whereas he already was a real sophisticate in terms of what he listened to, and you know, the amount that he'd read, and you know, probably a lot more cultured really than I was. And I can remember just always thinking that you're making me feel like I've never been born. You know, I can just remember thinking this is very, very appropriate, in the sense that I kind of do feel like that. And that song, much more than so much I've ever listened to, that song has stayed with me over the decades. And I've also felt that in the way that I was saying, like the Rocky Raccoon, I'm always going to think of that when I say Gideon's Bible. Loads of times whenever people, just in life generally, not, I don't mean to do with, you know, cultural stuff, you know, whatever, literature, art, whatever, but just when anybody's ever been sort of telling me about something, an experience that is something so far out of my kind of, my own kind of experience, that always is a song that plays in my head.
Yeah.
It's, you're making me feel like I've never been born. And so, like, say no in the details about that, and, you know, it was your man Fonda, whatever, the near-death experience, all that's kind of interesting, right? But and it is really, really interesting, but it's also as well kind of peripheral at the same time to my appreciation of it, I suppose I would say.
It is weird. There are those kind of real personal associations, definitely, particularly with Beatles songs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Blue Jay Way will always remind me of my brother.
Why?
Because, well, we just used to, we got the Magical Mystery Tour CD. And we just, like, we couldn't believe how good Blue Jay Way was.
Yeah.
Because it was like music we were listening to at the time, in terms of it was, like, really kind of, you know, trippy or whatever.
Yeah.
It just felt part of all that. And it just, like, you know, it was just, yeah, quite magical listening to it.
Yeah.
So it always reminds me of him. You talked about your kind of upbringing there. And so when did you first hear the Beatles then? Do you remember?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. So my parents, you know, they didn't really listen to music as such. They would have had music on the radio and so on. And I remember whenever we would get like a stereo, or we got this long sort of this gramophone player thing, but it was kind of like, these were kind of like artifacts or whatever, as opposed to a means of playing music. But I had an uncle, and my dad's brother was a was a massive music fan, and he had a little room. So he was much younger than my, dad. So say whenever he was in his 20s, he would have been looking after me and my brother sometimes. And we would always ask, so he had this wee tiny attic room. He was really into Bo Diddley. He had a Bo Diddley memorabilia, a Bo Diddley shirt on the wall. There was like big Brando Wild One poster. There was one of the Stones maracas. There was all sorts of stuff. And we always asked him to play Yellow Submarine and Chuck Berry, My Ding-a-ling, right? This guy who had, you know, really brilliant musical taste was very, very accommodating. These two kids that just wanted to hear Yellow Submarine and My Ding-a-ling over and over again. So there was that. But then, so that was sort of my first introduction to the Beatles. But then, I don't know if you can remember this absolutely dreadful thing, Stars on 45. Can you remember that? Stars on 45, the Beatles.
Oh, the medley.
The medley,
I have heard it,
It was terrible. I think it's like a Dutch group, and it was just session musicians and people that sounded like the Beatles, and that came out, and I just remember it was massively, massively popular, and people were like, wow, all the Beatles songs are so catchy, because it was just it was an absolutely dreadful thing, because I think it was like, Sparks. I think it started off with Sparks, Beat the Clock and Funky Town, and then just went into Sugar Sugar for about 10 seconds, and then just hit a Beatles medley. So it was absolutely awful. I'm sure nobody else in the podcast has brought up this dreadful thing, but it was kind of, it did give people quite a taste for the Beatles. I just remember thinking they were basically contemporary. I don't know if where I live just outside Belfast was very, very different to other places at that time, but it was kind of like, if you went out, so say, for example, you went to one of these local hotels where they would have had a disco, they would have played maybe, they would have played something like, I don't know, Shannon, Let the Music Play, followed by the Beatles, followed by something else. It wasn't kind of compartmentalised or whatever. So we would have easily been dancing to the Beatles, you know, some things from those early albums or whatever, you know, whenever I was a teenager. And also, I don't know if anybody's ever mentioned this, but I used to listen to a thing on Radio Luxembourg called Beatles Bonanza. And it was, again, you know, this is early 1980s. It was a guy called Rob Jones, maybe. And it was about 3 hours of just nonstop Beatles on a Monday night.
Wow.
Tuesday night. Monday night was a thing called Battle of the Bands. So it would be really, really weird. They would like pit, like, say, Steely Dan versus Velvet Underground. And they would just play them.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, people would phone in and give reasons as to why, you know, they thought Steely Dan, Bell and Velvet Underground or whatever. So that was Monday night. And then Tuesday night was just 3 hours of Beatles.
And was the Beatles Bonanza, was it completely throughout their career, or was it?
Completely throughout their career. And just all sorts of, just completely throughout the career and all sorts of, you know, just stuff from all the albums. And people made requests, and that was it. So that would have been, so to be honest, you know, I think the Beatles were probably pretty much to the forefront of my musical experience as a teenager, because that was a pretty weekly thing for a few years, and they just would have been played. Just would have been played all the time, really.
And so there wasn't ever a sense of them that some guests we have say were in the 80s, the Beatles were a little bit uncool or something. And when
I was in quite an uncool place, Belfast. So maybe if you've got some of these people coming on that are from, you know, metropolises or whatever, they never really seem very uncool. And also another thing as well was that, like, say, for example, 80s Belfast, another thing, 60s were really popular, sort of mod revival thing, Jam, all of that, you know. So then that also would have fed into people thinking the Beatles were really pretty good.
Mm,
yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, no, I would never have thought that people would have been saying they were on kill.
Well, I'd love to talk about your collection, Sweet Home. There's a brilliant story in there, which is called 77 pop facts you didn't know about Gil Courtney. And it takes the form of a kind of, series of almost kind of smash hits style, but like slightly more kind of sophisticated, I suppose. But although Smash Hits was very sophisticated. But I mean, it's a kind of series of facts about this fictional musician, Gil Courtney, who grew up in Belfast. And I just love, it's so good. And it reminds me of a lot of other musicians, because as the facts progress, we realize he kind of led quite a tragic life and became very reclusive. And like, I've got a few people who I think it might be about, but do you want to sort of tell the story about how he came up with that idea and the influences behind it?
Yeah, sure, Robin. Yes, I mean, I kind of, I suppose what I'm naturally drawn to are the people that things haven't worked out for. So every single time they're going to be of more interest to me than the people that are success stories. Yeah. And I kind of knew that I wanted to write something about a kind of a person that had been in some way, I suppose, a sort of rock and roll casualty or whatever. Mm. And, you know, I love Gene Clark and, I mean, it's kind of preposterous for me to sort of paint Gene Clark as someone that life didn't work out for. Whenever, you know, look what he achieved. He was phenomenal. He's fantastic. But I kind of wanted to look at someone who possibly had everything in place to do well, but just own personal frailties or circumstances meant it didn't happen. And I kind of thought that I love reading. I just read a lot of kind of like rock biographies or whatever. Yeah. So sorry, I've got a lot of stuff here that I would kind of like to use. So I came up with this character, Gil Courtney, and it kind of was, even the name was sort of a blend of, you know, Gil Scott Heron, Bobby Gillespie, Courtney Love, Courtney Barnett. So I was even trying to do it so it actually sounded, there were resonances of other people. Yeah. So I ended up writing all about this person, and I just couldn't get it to work. And I wrote about 20,000 words or 25,000 right. words, yeah. And I was writing and thinking, who would want to read this? I find it funny, you know, imagine him on stage with Steve Marriott, or Steve Marriott staying with his mum and all this. But who else is interested in this other than a handful of people? And then I wrote it from the point of view of the mom. I wrote it from the point of view of him. I wrote it from the point of view of the manager. And nothing ever took off. And then I was chatting to a friend, writer Sean O'Reilly, and he was saying your problem is that the form isn't reflecting the subject matter. Is there no other way you can tell that, where form is more conducive to telling this than the typical short story format? And I just thought the smash hits pop.
Yeah.
And as soon as I struck on that, I wrote it in one night. I was able to cut so much of it, and I was on a total high because I kind of knew that this was now working, you know.
Amazing.
And so that was great. But the funny thing about it as well is that because it's pop facts, a lot of people have kind of thought that this is a real person.
Yeah. Well, I had to Google him, I must admit.
Well, you know, there's things like, whenever you look at it, he couldn't possibly have done all the stuff he's done, because one minute he's in Hamburg, the next minute he's, you know, he's in London. It couldn't really playing, all have happened.
Playing the Star Club, indeed.
Yes, you know? Exactly. So playing the Star Club, and, you know, he's been everywhere and he's known absolutely everybody. But then as well, you think about somebody like Alex Chilton, and whenever you look at the people he played with and whatever, you can nearly say it seems incredible that one person could have done all of that. But I've had people say, oh, you know, I've actually heard his record, the Volante, made up this album, Volante Blue. I didn't think it was all that. I can understand it. I feel like this person doesn't exist, you know.
And did you have an idea of how that music would sound when you were writing it?
I suppose I was thinking sort of, I don't know, sort of Terry Riley sort of kind of thing. Yeah. But it was also as well reading, because he was a keyboard player, I was also reading quite a lot about Nicky Hopkins. So I love the Julian Dawson, Nicky Hopkins book. And so I was kind of imagining him slight with a kind of Nicky Hopkins attitude as well. Yeah, and I suppose as well, I was kind of thinking too about just those sort of people in studios that are really difficult. So I was kind of thinking about, you know, because he says, I say, play it like whatever it is on a tat, you know, make it sound like it's a peach. Like it sounds
very John Lennon.
Exactly. So I was kind of thinking about that type of thing.
It was John Lennon was, didn't he want it to sound like an orange? That was one of the quotes. I mean, I thought Syd Barrett would be an obvious.
And Syd Barrett, Syd Barrett,
But then, but also Kevin Ayers. Do you know do you like Kevin Ayers' music?
Yeah, Kevin Ayers,
Because when Kevin Ayers died, they a few years ago, they reprinted in The Guardian, I think, his last interview. And it's very, very sad. He was living in France. And he, you know, he was a terrible alcoholic. And he said something like, I just live my life like, I'm sitting down, oh, here's this meal, you know, and it's like he's just found himself having breakfast, you know. It's kind of like, and his whole life was like this, oh, I'm doing this album now. There's albums he can't remember making, you know, in the 70s and 80s. It's very sad.
Yeah.
And it was a very sad portrait of just this enormously talented, funny man, you know, but that's really what it reminded me of.
My key thing in that story was that the album had been really pretty much a flop. But I don't know if you can remember that one of the pop facts was about in a guy in Leeds, a student TV club, were interviewing people in the street and asking them about the music that meant most to them, and this one random guy in an anorak in Leeds said Gil Courtney and Volonté Blue, and how it was sort of so transporting. And, you know, it's kind of like the validity of stuff that even gets such an absolutely minuscule audience. It can still speak to, is there still a validity to doing that, pursuing that, if you've got a really, really, really small audience? And then, of course, like the bus passed just as they were recording this, so they couldn't use it anyway. Yes. So I suppose just interested in that idea, you know, that this Gil Courtney's family, you know, or neighbours were saying, why bother with that at all? He could have had a life that was pretty steady, mundane, and maybe longer and happier.
Or not. Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things Muldoon says about McCartney, is he imagines Paul McCartney could have been this teacher, this English teacher, or maybe a don or something, you know. He imagines him with a mortarboard instead of a mop top or something like that. Yeah. But there's something nice about that. That kind of what could have been. And yeah, so are there any kind of, you said you read a lot of kind of rock biographies. Are there any kind of Beatle books you've read and particularly like?
Did you like the Kevin Barry one, Beatle?
I haven't read that yet. I mean, I've got that on the shelf and I really want to read that. Have you read it?
Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
So this is like a kind of novelization about John Lennon, isn't it? Could you explain a bit more about what that's about? I'm definitely going to read this.
Well, it's about John Lennon and arriving in an island off the coast of Ireland, and just basically what happens, what transpires, you know.
Cool. And when is it kind of set in the fictional world or the real world?
I couldn't tell you what year it would, because he did have an island, isn't that right?
So the island of Dorinch in Clew Bay in County Mayo, Ireland, was previously owned by John Lennon, who purchased the island in 1967 for £1,700, and the island became a place of peace for Lennon and his family. I'm reading from Wikipedia. After his divorce from Cynthia, the island went unused until Lennon invited King of the Hippies Sid Rule and Timmy Walsh to establish a commune on the island in 1970. And the novel Beetle Bone is a kind of fictionalised road trip around the west of Ireland in 1978 by John Lennon. So it sounds absolutely fascinating. Can't wait to read it. And there is a Beatles Books podcast interview with Kevin Barry, so that's worth checking out too. Bye.
It's definitely worth a read for sure.
Do you listen to the Beatles a lot now? Are they part of
your
music?
I do listen to the Beatles on and off, and I would listen to the White Album more than any other one. And I can remember I moved to Newcastle upon Tyne in 1993, and I listened to the White Album a lot whenever I lived in Newcastle, and it would still probably be my favourite. It would be my favourite Beatles album, and I've got a 19-year-old daughter. I was just speaking to her before I came here to talk to you. And I was saying to her, I was saying, do you listen to the Beatles? And she went, yes. And I said, well, what do you listen to? And she said, the White Album as well. So that was kind of quite nice.
Nice. And what is it about the White Album for you, do you think?
I just think, and again, I know I'm not saying anything new. I know all this is probably a bit of a cliche, but I think it's just got it feels really spacious, and it feels like something that when you listen to it each time, you hear something that's kind of quite different. Even though you've listened to it for many decades now, because I'm not very young, hear new sorts of things, and I also find it funny. And I know that's something. If you told me, do you want to listen to a humorous record? I'd be absolutely not. Similarly, if you said to me, oh, do you want to meet this person? They're so witty. It's just like, what a turn off, the witty person. Yeah. Going to be a total self-regarding idiot. Or somebody said, they write comic novels. Dreadful, but I do find I find back in the USSR really funny, and I find why don't we do it in the road really funny as well. But not in a let's fall off with the chair laughing, but I just like them, and I just think it just feels still. You can keep listening to it and hearing more and more in it, basically. And I do love the lyrics as well, that thing where you don't, I suppose it's like that Keats thing, negative capability, where you don't always need to be reaching after kind of logic and reason, and all the things that we're saying earlier about things people can tolerate in song lyrics really, really easily, that they can't in poetry and literature, maybe, where they're trying to grasp a very specific meaning. I just think happiness is a warm gun, and so much else there. It just yields all sorts of interesting ideas and interesting meanings and so on.
Sure,
And I also like things where there's some stuff that I don't really get, maybe, or I don't really like, but they're so part and parcel of the whole. Like, I'm a Stones fan too, and like Exile on Main Street, I listen to tons, but there's some of the, I can't stand some, even though it's one of my favourites, there's some things on it I don't like. And I try not to skip those things, because I kind of feel it's part and parcel of what it is.
Totally. I mean, on this podcast, the two songs which get the most hate are Obladi Oblada and Piggies. I never skip them, and I actually quite like Piggies. I mean, you kind of need it there. I think it's kind of interesting. It's got nice chords. But I think, what you're talking about, what you were saying there, for me, I was thinking, Cry Baby Cry is the song on the White Album where I always just think that sums up its own little world. And if you were to describe the White Album, you might say, like, voices out of nowhere put on specially by the children for a lark, That seems to sum up the White Album for me. Yeah. In that it's quite spooky, but it is funny. And it's
the way Cry Baby Cry just builds and builds.
Yeah. It's great.
It's great.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. And do you have one question we ask all our guests? Do you have a kind of controversial Beatles opinion? Is there like a well-known song you really hate, or
I don't know if this quite fits the bill, but I can remember it's Jealous Guy, right? And I can remember, obviously, I was a bit of a nitwit whenever I was younger, right? But I can remember whenever Roxy Music released Jealous Guy, I remember being sort of shocked and thinking, that's really quite, they're singing from the point of view of that guy, Mark Chapman, right? And that's what I thought, that As a nitwit, that's what I thought at the time.
Really?
This was that they were singing from his point of view, and I thought, what an unusual...
Well, you just kind of jumped to that
I jumped to that conclusion.
Yeah.
And
right.
Later on, I've realised that also many other people thought that same thing.
Really?
Many other people thought that, yeah. And I noticed that the Mark Chapman... is there some sort of documentary out now about him? It's called Jealous Guy. No, I was foolish. It was ridiculous to think that, but many other people were foolish and ridiculous. To me, it still seems that it's a funny song.
Yeah,
them to have covered.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, so when did that cover come out then? So was
I think it must have been about, what was it, 19?
Google time. Oh, yeah, following Lennon's death in 1980, Roxy Music added a version of the song to their set while touring in Germany, which they recorded and released in February 81, so really soon after, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was at that stage, what would I have been, 13 or whatever, and I can remember thinking, that's a really weird thing to do, to have a song that's about that guy.
Yeah, it's not a choice.
And so obviously I got it totally wrong, but as well, I wasn't alone in getting it totally wrong.
Yeah. So strange.
It is strange. It's really strange. Yeah. So that Mark Chapman documentary is called Jealous Guy.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, weird. What a creepy note to end on.
maybe it's too creepy to be used.
No, it's fine. I mean, yeah, sorry, we've kept you for over an hour. I'm used to saying we because Jack isn't here, because I'm just using the royal we.
It's been a total pleasure, honestly. It really has.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
It's been fantastic.
There's lots of chat about Muldoon, which I really enjoyed. Because I went to uni when Paul Muldoon was professor of poetry at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've sort of been following his career for a long time. And he did these lectures at Oxford, and I'm convinced now they were a piss take. Because when you would go to the lecture and it would be an hour long, and he'd start at this one point of a poem, and he'd detour so far from it, and you'd drift off, and you'd kind of go, "What? How's he got here?" And like, I'm sure he was like kind of slightly deconstructing the idea of being a professor of poetry, you know. It was brilliant. Anyway, I could ramble on for ages.
No, he's brilliant. I met him, right, this sounds so showbizzy, but I met him in this place, Los Gatos in California. This bizarre festival that featured Van Morrison's daughter. And I was up at this event cutting a bit of cheese, and he came over and he said, I didn't even know who was speaking to me. And the voice said, I'm going to see Trent Reznor soon. Do you like Trent Reznor? And I turned around and it was Paul Muldoon. And it was so surreal. The whole thing was so surreal. But he's just, I think, a great individual. Absolutely brilliant, you know.
Yeah, and really funny.
Yeah.
The poems are funny. Yeah. Brilliant. Awesome. Well, yeah, Wendy, thank you so much for your time.
No, my pleasure. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. So thank you.
So that was the brilliant Wendy Erskine. I really, really enjoyed listening to that, especially just, you know, not having to listen to the sound of my honking old voice.
It was great.
It was really great. You did a fantastic job on your own.
Thank you. Thank you. I kept sort of saying we. It sort of sounded like the royal we.
Yeah.
But, no, it was great. She was so lovely. It was brilliant to chat to her. And definitely check out her book, Sweet Home. It's fantastic.
Brilliant. Mm. So we're going to be back in an indefinite amount of time with another podcast with the brilliant Sean Keaveney.
Yeah.
Formerly of Six Music, now a podcaster.
Yeah. And we'll also hopefully do a post Get Back one of some description where we kind of digest the Get Back film as well.
Yeah, so, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coming quick now, isn't it? It's only a couple of weeks away.
Yeah.
Incredibly exciting stuff. If you want to keep sending in your own personal Beatles stories, then our email is very much still active. You can go to personalbeatles.com/contact or email me jack@homespunsounds.com. Until then,
keep on beatling.
No, keep beatling on.
Oh, sorry.
Stop getting the catchphrase wrong. keep on beetling.
But keep beetling on just sounds so much worse.
I know, that's why it's good. Keep beetling on.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.